Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really incredible founder, you know, a founder that has been riding the ship, you know, of her startup since 2013. So now we are on our way to 11 years. You know, there is saying 16 times, you know, that they have experienced and survived, you know, what is called the crypto winters. And really inspiring journey, you know, when it comes to building, scaling, financing. They've raised over $80 million. And really inspiring background story and beyond. So brace yourself for a very interesting conversation. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today. And that is going to be, let's see if I pronounce it very well here, Elizabeth Rossiello. Welcome to the show.
Perfectly pronounced. Thanks for having me.
So born and raised in Queens, New York, Elizabeth. So tell us about life growing up. Give us a walk through memory lane.
Well, I'm from a community in Queens, which is, I think, still the borough in the United States that speaks the most languages. And everybody in my elementary school was from a different country. So I grew up in a really multicultural, international setting. Everybody was an immigrant. Everybody had different food at home. Everybody had different languages. Everybody had different customs. So already from an early age, I was aware that there was life beyond my own family, which was cool and set the tone. And then I kind of continued on and became a nomad pretty early. I left Queens to go to school at a fancy school in Manhattan. And then right after my undergraduate, I went to Europe and I kind of never came home. So those early steps where I grew up, it was a bit of a rough neighborhood, I won't lie. When I go back there with my kids, they're like, whoa, mom. But it really developed a resilience early age and taught me that if I wanted to get out and see the world, I'd have to do it myself.
So then what kind of perspective would you say it gave you? I mean, obviously being in a multicultural area like you were in Queens, kind of like opened up, you know, a lot the way that you thought about life, about the world. I guess as you were getting out of New York, and as you were now in Europe and you were experiencing that there was a world outside of the US and outside of Queens, what kind of perspective do you think that gave you?
You know, it's also interesting because when you grow up in an immigrant neighborhood where everybody is from a different place, you're representing your own culture and to other people at all times. I was explaining what it meant to be Italian American, why my family ate certain food, or what we went to church, or what traditions we had, to my Chinese American and my Russian American friends. So you're kind of representing yourself. You're like a little founder already, you know, representing your community and getting along. And it teaches you to communicate with people who have a different worldview. Even now, I'll meet people, my age mates, who I think are international, who went to international business school, who have traveled. And they really struggle to communicate with people who think differently than they do. They're like, well, why won't he understand that? Or why don't they accept this? And for me, I'm always thinking, where are they coming from? What do they know? How do they make decisions? What level of context do they need? And it's really set the tone for how our team now, which is from all over the world, communicates. And I think I didn't realize I had that in me until I became a leader, but I really do believe that's from where I grew up.
And obviously there was like a really interesting transition of events to the professional level, because you started in government, then from government to banking, then banking kind of like give you that exposure to microfinance. And I think that was kind of like the segue to getting going as a founder. But walk us through, what was the thought process behind perhaps starting from government, how that, you know, got you into banking, and then how that eventually led you into founding the business?
Well, I've talked about this before, but, you know, I didn't really know about that many careers. I didn't really know. My whole family are public school or state school teachers. You know, everybody, it's the family business is to work for the city. And, you know, firemen, policemen, sanitation workers, maybe there's some independent contractors who do construction work, but that's it. So I didn't know what careers were out there, but I did know that smart people could become lawyers or doctors. That was always talked about in the neighborhood and by my parents. So I was kind of pushed to think that I would be one of those two things. And, you know, when you go to school in the city, and I traveled to another planet going to school in the Upper East Side. And there, my friend's parents were like, I'm an Oscar winner, or I write the music for Sesame Street, or, you know, I own 12 magazines. I was like, what are these jobs? One person was like a photographer, you know, things you didn't know about. And so a lot of my career has been taking a step of what I knew, what I could see. And then once I got there, looking around and saying, oh, wait, I can go higher. I can go higher. And I think, you know, it was exciting to me to see what was next. So one of my first internships was a friend's mom who was a lawyer, and she worked at a hospital. And I got to see a little bit about what that looked like and what policy looked like. And then I took a class, and I had a politics teacher who was very inspiring. So he showed me how to get an internship, and I applied for one in Germany because I spoke German. So it was always just taking these baby steps. And then when I got there, who can I learn from now? Who can be my mentor now? And not being afraid to change and to say, what's next? And what am I good at now? And I think I just realized if you have these basic skill sets, if you have this kind of hustle and this curiosity, and you're not afraid to communicate, and you're not afraid of the new, you can kind of step from one thing to another. What brought me to finance was I went to a degree at Columbia University at the School of International Affairs. Everybody was very international. You have to speak two languages to go there, or three languages, two foreign languages. And I started taking classes at the engineering school and at the business school. And I realized that would be a great way to pay for my student loans. So I went into finance just thinking that. And then when I got there, I saw, oh, I can do this. I can do that.
So then how microfinance comes knocking to you? Because it sounds like microfinance, you know, had like got you hooked.
Yeah, well, remember, look, this was 2007. I was working in prime brokerage and sales and trading. I was in Zurich. Credit Suisse was doing well then. I was working for a Swiss bank in Switzerland. You know, I had the languages under my belt. I was like rising star as an analyst. I was traveling back and forth, New York, London, Zurich. It was a great life. But I hated the way I was treated. I hated the way women were treated. I found the culture terrible. And even though I was excelling, I was like, I don't like anybody here. And, you know, my managing director was really cool and very kind to me, and also from Queens, New York. But everybody else, I was like, I don't know if I want a career with these people. So I was doing a lot of research online about what was next. And Muhammad Yunus had just won the Nobel Peace Prize in microfinance. And everybody was talking about this. And even Credit Suisse at the time had created a microfinance division to invest in this new class of finance, which could do good, but be profitable. Right. So it was like a baby step. And that's kind of how I got into it. And I just started interviewing secretly for jobs related to that. And I found one in Nairobi that sent me there.
So then let's talk about Africa, because I mean, Africa is quite the, you know, like a different, you know, place from Europe. So walk us through the opportunity of going to Africa, because I know that Africa was quite pivotal to in your journey to become a founder.
Yeah. And honestly, I applied for a job in Manila. So they sent me to Nairobi. It wasn't originally my selection. So it was totally random that I got sent there. And, you know, I'm a big Chinua Achebe fan. Like, things fall apart. I was like, why does Africa need me? You know, what does Elizabeth from Queens need to be going here? What can I show anybody there? So I went pretty humble, thinking like, you know, I thought it was strange that Westerners or Americans were, you know, going to Africa. I always kind of identified it with like a missionary thing. And then when I got there, Nairobi was booming and there was so much going on and the financial sector was booming. And I was like, wow, this is really exciting. And, you know, I just did my little job, tried to help where I could. And I just put my head down and worked. And I went bank to bank all over the continent. And I would do deep dives into their technology, into their risk, into their trading, into their portfolio, their product, visit their clients. I'd go to visit branches, you know, fishing people, industrial people all over the continent. In Ghana, I would travel on a bus. In Malawi, I would travel on a motorcycle. I mean, it was really crazy. And then I'd go to the boardroom. And usually in the boardroom, it would be the local microfinance board and then always like a European board member. And I'm like, what is this guy doing here? And I soon realized all of the funding was coming from Europe and the US in dollar and euro. And not only was it like this weird colonialism set up, of like, you know, what was going on. But also it was really an efficient way to fund, especially when these little banks were on lending in local currency. So I found it super strange. And again, I just had that New York spunk where I was like, hey, this isn't right. This is strange. This is weird. And so I started mentioning it in my research reports and people were like, shh. And then I started mentioning it when I did trainings. And then I started getting side hustle gigs as like, you know, PwC would come down and do a training on microfinance and they'd hire me to lead it. Or the Central Bank of South Sudan wanted a trainer to go in and talk about legislation. So I started like doing all these things where I had a platform for talking about what I'd been learning. And yeah, that became my niche for like 7 years.
So then walk us through that moment where you decide to take a, you know, reins of your own destiny, of your own future and become an entrepreneur.
Well, I always say becoming an entrepreneur is a privilege in some ways because a lot of people don't have the money to just not take an income and to be an entrepreneur. So you're either a student and you're broke anyway, you have some money you saved up, or you have privately wealthy. Because I couldn't become an entrepreneur. I couldn't miss a paycheck. And I was just finished paying off my student loans and had been recently married and wasn't getting any financial help from that. And I had had two kids right in a row. I had a 1 and a 2-year-old. And I lost my job. They put somebody else. They like closed the office and I started doing consulting. And I couldn't really get enough consulting work. And I started talking about how everybody wanted me to work for free. They'd come and ask me questions. Oh, just come for a casual dinner and then pump me for information. Come for a little chat. We're setting up an office here. Pump me for information. You know, all those coffees and lunches and dinners, even like asking me for email. I was dumb and young and gave away a lot of free information. And then finally, I met someone who said, you know, Elizabeth, you're one of the smartest people I know. You have all this talent. Here you are. You don't realize it. Why don't you just do something for yourself? And there is no entrepreneur bone. You know, you can do this. So it was really a thought shift. And it came from other people, actually, and some good friends. And then I met a seed investor who was going around Nairobi saying, I'm looking for entrepreneurs to start something. And he gave us a $50,000 check, which not at once, but he paid the bills for like the first 3 months while we got up and running. And by month three, I had won another $50,000 check from the World Bank. And then a month later, I got investment from venture. So I think if I hadn't met that original seed investor, I wouldn't have had the luxury of starting my own company. And so I think it's important to say that, especially for women with children, especially for women who don't have help, you know, that's really what I needed to get going.
So what ended up becoming the business model of the company?
So right away, we were called BitPesa at the time. We were the first company in the entire world to trade African currencies against crypto, and definitely the first to trade crypto against mobile money. There was a Kapochi, which is a really cool wallet that was there, but we were the first exchange. And we launched it with a retail model, so Kenyan shilling to Bitcoin, delivered straight into the M-Pesa mobile money wallet. You could buy and sell in seconds. And it was up and running. I think by month three, we had it going. And yeah, we got a lot of international attention. We were one of the first African companies in the space. I think Luno hadn't started yet. And it was just a wild ride from literally month one.
And I know that there were even some wild events happening on year one. What happened with the government?
So after, well, we had a great first year, where the head of Google Kenya invested. Barry Silbert from DCG found me on LinkedIn and invested. I had, you know, calls with Nick Carey and Peter Smith from blockchain. You know, everybody, Charles Hoskinson from Ada, Skype called me. How funny is that? You know, all these crypto guys, these like legend guys called me and we were talking and I got flown to Necker Island. All these cool things were happening. And then lo and behold, the local telecom, Safaricom, decided they didn't like that we were using their platform. Now, we were paying them money. We were using their platform like everybody else. There was no regulation about it, but the Kenyan government got involved and they sued us. And so my advisor at the time said, it's not a fight without a punch. Terrible advice. and we sued back and we went into court and I found out what it was like to sue the largest monopoly in Kenya, who holds up like 80% of the stock exchange and is government funded. We got, you know, trashed in the press, full page ads from the central bank with our names in it. It was wild and we were young and dumb, but we survived.
Wow. And how do you think that builds you up too? Because I mean, I think that that helps to get that thick skin, you know, going as well.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was so crazy, but at the time, you know, the blockchain, the crypto community was so, you know, values based, I want to say. We were like, oh, let's change the world. Everybody's read the white paper. It was still very early days. And I had been in the system. I had worked in investment banking. I had worked in development finance, which I thought was kind of a scam, you know, like everybody goes there to save the world, but they're just as, you know, profit minded and it was still a colonial mindset as anywhere else. And I was just like fed up. And I didn't want to say that I was a libertarian because I'm still not, but I was really passionate about what we were doing. And we said, we have customers, we're getting attention all around the world. This innovation is amazing. It will help your own product. I didn't really believe there was a logical reason why we should be in so much trouble. I really felt like people were afraid of the new, and that fueled me.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Talk to us too about capital raising, because you alluded to it earlier, how you started getting investors and Barry Silver, then, you know, speaking with other people like Peter Smith. And so all in all, how much capital have you guys raised to date? And how has it been the experience too of going through the motions of going from one financing cycle to the next?
Yeah, well, it's been very tough. First, as a female, where only 2% of capital is even available to me. And as a female working in Africa, which becomes in and out of favor, and then with a crypto and a payments component, sometimes we're more crypto or less crypto or stablecoin or not. So depending on the cycle. And now I've been doing it 11 years. So when I was young and shiny, you know, even though I was a working mom and I didn't look like a lot of the people were investing in, I was like the only girl and the only person in Africa. So very shiny. And everybody gave me a seed investment. And that round came together pretty easy. And then a year or two later, when we needed more to expand, we got a top up. And Pantera joined us. Blockchain Capital joined us. And then came the years where we were really building, where we were saying, you know, everybody wants on and off ramps on this continent. That takes time. You know, it's not like you just build in Europe. Even Circle at the time didn't have a license in the UK and Europe. And in 2015, just 2 years later, we were licensed by the FCA, one of the first companies that had blockchain involved in their payments plan. And we got that license with almost no funding. And then we started to realize that venture has a short attention span. So we had revenue, we were growing, you know, we're getting along there, but we were like, we need to go to West Africa. If you really want to do remittances to Africa, you can't just be in one country. You have to really think about how do you do a Pan-African network. And that's what we started building. And then it became very hard to raise money. And we had a down round and we got non-crypto venture for the first time from Draper and Graycroft. And, you know, we learned a lot of lessons through that. We got lean and we really started to grow. And then our revenue started to grow. We made the big leap of leaving Kenya. And my co-founder went to the UK and I went to Nigeria and our team stayed in Kenya, but we kept expanding. We ended up very successfully opening Nigeria, opening up the UK, moving on into other markets. But at the same time, we didn't really see venture interested in building an infrastructure company. They were like, we want to see the revenue. And we're like, well, what about the infrastructure? This would be a huge on and off ramp. Payment companies later on will want to build it. But we didn't have that long-term financing. I think in emerging markets where people worry about risk, they want things done quick. But at the same time, in emerging markets, things take time. So that was a bit of a struggle. And as crypto came in and out of favor in different cycles, we would either attract crypto funding or be repelled by, you know, TradFi or non-crypto. So it was a wild ride up and down. And then we were doing really well. We had, you know, huge revenues in one market in Nigeria. We were profitable. Things were great. And then the Nigerian government decided to shut down all international companies and stop the use of the local currency as a payments mechanism. And they only allowed dollar payments. And this was in January 2021. And we thought the world was going to end. We went from, you know, millions of dollars of revenue a month to hundreds of dollars of revenue in just 1 month. And I think a couple of companies exited the market. Partner companies were calling, you know, backstabbing, calling the regulator. There were a lot of crazy phone calls. You know, there were all this sort of jockeying for position. I remember it was over Christmas. Everything crazy always happens over Christmas break. And we were like, is this it? And then we realized it's not it. This is not where we end. And we just dug deep, took the cash we had, bought a company in South Africa we had been working on buying, deployed all of our cash to open up new markets, and just raced into other markets with our really good team. And it was a lot of work. And we basically rebuilt the company. So from being an almost purely Nigerian company with a little bit of Kenyan business, we went into Ghana, Central Africa, West Africa, South Africa. And by the latter 6 months of the year, we had regained our ARR. So going from almost zero revenue Jan to June to doing, you know, over 10 million of revenue the second half of the year alone on all new markets. And after that, we were like, we're invincible. We can do anything. And then a lot of investors were like, wow, that was so amazing. No one could have done that. But, you know, you're a 6-7-year-old company. Yeah. You know, we'd rather invest in a brand new company. So we really struggled with that concept because we had showed what it takes to build on this continent. What kind of resilience, what kind of know-how, what kind of team. And we didn't really see investors understanding that. And we raised along the way. And that's why we did eventually a partnership with FTX. And we eventually got money from the Development Bank of South Africa. But I would say this whole process has left me quite jaded in what people invest in. And now, you know, we're doing a round right now. And I think we see from a lot of strategic partners, tons of interest in the infrastructure we've built. And they're like, how did you possibly build this? But along the way, we didn't see a lot of investors understand that journey or be there to really invest in that journey.
So FTX, you mentioned FTX. I mean, that was quite a moment for you guys too. How did you navigate that craziness?
Well, life has been crazy. So we were used to crazies. Like with any partner, we know who we are. Not to go back to, you know, not to be cheesy and loop it back to the beginning, but I know what my culture is. I know what my values are. Even if I'm communicating to other cultures and other kinds of people, I can't change, you know, my own values. We stayed true to who we were as Azza and we built things for them, but we were very careful not to change the fundamentals of our company. So when they would say things like, hey, let's erase all the information on our Slack channels. We would be like, nope, you know, that's not exactly our company culture and we're not going to do that. You can, you know, so we built a lot of barriers around us and we worked to launch them in a few markets and there was a lot of press about it, a lot of, you know, noise, and we enabled their entry into a couple of markets. So when they went down, it was rough. We had to do a lot of repair work. We had to work with all our regulators, all of our advisors and authorities and clients. And it took a good year and a half to recover all those relationships.
So then in this case, I guess, you know, it's been quite a while, right? No, you have the 16 crypto winters, you have FTX, you have those battles with the government. It's crazy. But obviously, you know, like when you're able to go through all these different cycles, it's because there's a bigger purpose. You know, there's a bigger thing that you guys are going after. And I think that that also, you know, helps to bring on board investors, to bring on board customers, employees. So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Elizabeth, and you would wake up in a world where the vision of the company is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, I think it's just the support, I think, from, I think we need an, well, let's go back. I think what we need in my own company and companies like ours is more debt investment. We have a lot of equity investment at the seed stage. We have some at the growth stage, but then we don't have that debt facilities to help companies like ours really grow. It goes back to what I first started when I worked on this continent with all these microfinance institutions lending in dollar euro from faraway lenders who didn't understand their business models. We still have that same problem. We have development lenders on the continent. That's really it. We have quasi private lenders who most of them get money from development lenders. So their metrics are still not commercial. And that's really it. It's very hard to keep going. And I don't think the venture model works when you're past growth stage. Now you really need, you know, debt facilities. And we don't really see that available. So we're kind of, you know, we were one of the first companies to take debt from partners. We were one of the first to take it from clients. We were one of the first to take it from alternative methods. We're really like find ourselves always as the first, really pushing our way on how we can keep this business model going without the rest of the market being developed. And what keeps us waking up every morning is our clients. We have some of the biggest blue chip clients in the world. I have 34 of the largest remittance companies on planet Earth that trade with through me. And all this nonsense about, oh, blockchain for remittance, this and that. Here we go. I've got them 11 years. We also have 10 of the largest global payment companies. If I told you the names, it's like every single large payment company works with us. We also have some of the largest processors. Credit card. We have some of the biggest corporates, everybody from Heineken and Procter & Gamble to Total, you know, multi-choice. So what keeps me going in the beginning was the passion for the idea. What keeps me going the last 8 years is product market fit. Even if we don't have the best balance sheet, even if we have, you know, bad press from who we dealt with, even if a market is going tough, clients are clamoring for this product because they don't see anything else like it in the market. And they don't see the kind of coverage we have, the compliance we have, the product we have. And that drives us through the rainiest days. And I would not be getting up and I would not be able to keep a team going with me through all these ups and downs. You know, forget cult of personality or, you know, team culture, all good things to keep teams together. But if they don't see the product, they don't hear clients go, phew, thank gosh for you guys. I don't think that they're going to stick with you through ups and downs.
So then now that we're talking about the future, I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. You know, if you were to go back in time, you know, to that moment that, you know, you were in Africa and seeing all the issues that you were seeing, you know, let's say we go back to 2013 and you have the opportunity of giving that younger Elizabeth one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
It would be to network more with people you don't like. Is that a crazy thing to say? I think I was like, ugh, don't want to deal with these people. I don't like them. I don't share values with them. So I'm going to just ignore them. And then I needed their capital. And so then you're like, oh, you know, I think take it or leave it. If you want a company that needs financing, you have to know the financiers. You know, you have to get to know these funds. You have to network these funds. And I don't mean just once a year. I mean, you really have to be sending them weekly updates, calling them, coffees, meetings, dinners, networking events, all the stuff that is really distracting if you're a focused operator. And that's what I would consider myself, a founder operator. I don't like doing that stuff. I do a lot of press, but I always do it from my office. You really do need to network because capital is not fungible. Capital is not efficiently allocated. This isn't a mathematics class. People don't allocate capital by mathematical formulas. They allocate capital through who they know and what they know. And going back to that first example, people only know what they've been exposed to. And it's really hard for some people to see the vision or see, you know, the future when they haven't experienced it. I don't care how many venture capitalists say they're innovative thinkers or they're out there to seek the future. A lot of them can't see beyond what they know. And they all look and have a lot of the same experience. So it's very hard for them to understand. And, you know, I'll get together with some other African founders and we're always talking about the same thing. Can you believe they asked us this? Or can you believe they don't understand this? Or so I think there's still a need to communicate across from your special. And this could work if you're like at the frontier of technology and you're dealing with venture capitalists who don't understand your technology, or if you're like in a medical device or you were in AI before anybody thought that was interesting, or all these frontier places, whether it's a frontier geography or a frontier product, it's really important for you to communicate that into a digestible way and a non-intimidating way and really network with the people who you'll need going forward. I don't always believe that no matter what, even if you work in a dark closet, if you're good at what you do, money will find you. I don't believe that. And that's something, I think that's a lie we tell founders. If you're good enough, they'll find you. No. You know how many really smart kids I met in Senegal or Nairobi who didn't go to Stanford? They were brilliant, but Stanford didn't find them. You know, you have to go travel there, do summer camps, hire a consultant, then you get into that school. So I think it's a real misconception that it'll just find you. You have to actively build that road and network and put yourself out there.
That's amazing, Elizabeth. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
LinkedIn, Twitter.
Amazing. Well, that's easy enough. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.